Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Right now, the teachers who are in the schools, the survivors, I would say, because as you, I think, aptly know, most teachers with a conscience are going to leave within 5 years, and that's true. The ones who survive these days, the ones who are riding out to their pension days, have figured out that the best thing to do is just to pass them along, because if they don't rock the boat, and as long as they get the grades, stuff like that, and they get the graduation rates, they get the funding, they don't get the scrutiny, and it's just not worth the hassle to battle the students on grades. Now, again, this isn't to say that, you know, I like grading, because I don't. This isn't to say I like compulsory schooling, but just by their own standards, again, the compulsory schooling paradigm standards, it's all a farce at this point from what I've seen and what I've heard from, of course, many different, you know, people who are teaching across many different states. It's all the same. At the mainstream public school level, virtually all students are getting passed along for the sake of graduation rates and numbers, and because, you know, principals put pressure on them to literally make sure that they get good grades. And I actually had that experience personally. My grades that I had for certain students were changed behind my back.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It's, you know, it's children's shoes in the Soviet Union. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Like, shoe factories got shoe quotas. You know, how do you make 10,000 pairs of shoes a month? You make them in size 4, right?
Yeah.
That's actually semi-poetic.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is Monday, February 17th. Hey, remember last week when I put out a bunch of content about the history of public schools? We talked about it from a variety of different angles. At a variety of levels of depth and detail, of course, concluding on Saturday with the release of In Pursuit of Utopia, Episode 7, with Danny McCarthy and Kevin Cole on the New Harmony community, a story that included some interesting and unknown roots of both public schooling in the United States and socialism. What a week, huh? Perhaps it left some of you wondering, like, well, okay, yeah, now I know more about what was going on as far as school history and politics were concerned in the 1850s and the 1910s and the 1960s, but what about today? Tell us how things have improved. I'm sorry, I don't have a great story about that. Well, I dug into that a little bit at the end of the show on Wednesday with Pete Canones. This week, we will take a closer look at the contemporary issues of public schooling, what all of that conversation last week was leading up to, what is going on in these schools in 2020. And I'm joined by a long overdue guest called The Honest Teacher. That is a Facebook page run by somebody who was working in these schools up until recently and now is running a tutoring business like I used to do back when I started School Sucks Podcast. So we are going to get an up-to-date picture. I have somebody on the show today who can speak to the specifics of how children are still being controlled and shamed into submission. This was a long conversation that covered a lot of ground. It will be split into two parts, the first today, the second on Wednesday. You're going to want to hear both. And while there is a lot of doom and gloom, we do, in the end, bring it to a positive conclusion. And like I said, this is a long overdue conversation. People have been requesting finding out who the Honest Teacher is. I did not find out specifically who he is, but we did start talking a while back. His Facebook page is great. He speaks the same language we do here. Lots of posts referencing some of our favorite educational thinkers and school critics, people like Connor Boyack, John Taylor Gatto, Peter Gray. And another reason is, like, I'm doing this show called School Sucks. I have a website called schoolsucksproject.com, but I haven't set foot in a public school since 2014. And every morning I wake up with this thought of, oh shit, what if it's all great now? I mean, that would be terrific for the kids who are there, but it would certainly put a good amount of egg on my face. Now, of course, I know that isn't true, but I am looking for ways to update you on the current state of schools more regularly Now, as far as the honest teacher and I are concerned, there's a lot of overlap in our stories. And this was a really great conversation. I would say I feel like this is one of the best conversations I've had on the show about school in a long, long time, maybe ever. So today is more of an introduction. I wanted to hear his story. We're going to answer questions like, does critical thinking exist in schools, in any place, in any form? What does that look like? Why are standards being lowered? What are color sticks? Wait till you hear about color sticks. For those of you who heard In Pursuit of Utopia, episode 7, and Kevin was talking about the socialist pioneer, Robert Owen, and how they used these colored rods to indicate to employees if they were working good enough or hard enough. How real-time grade awareness has increased student and parent stress. We will start to get into the Orwellian world of student monitoring, why teachers are fibbing grades, the politics of labeling students will be explained. And then in the second hour of this conversation coming Wednesday, we'll dig more into that student monitoring problem and the politics of labeling students. And then we'll start to move in a more positive direction, talking about the Honest Teacher Project and what the future holds. So that is it. I want to thank my friend Daryl Becker, who was not the first, but the most recent person to suggest the Honest Teacher as a guest. I am so glad this finally happened. And like I said, I will definitely be doing more with this man in the future. On a final note, thanks to everybody who has chipped in on Patreon over the last month. I'm going to be thanking you all one by one on the show very soon. Stay tuned for that. And I also need to remind you that the encore for the Ideas into Action Summit is coming up. It will run 3 consecutive Saturdays, March 7th, 14th, and 21st. That way you don't have to give up an entire weekend. But thank you so much to the people who were willing to do that when we first ran the summit in the fall of 2019. Even if you're hearing me say this and you're like, no, I'm already really great at research and I win every debate that I'm in, just go look at the page at sspuniversity.com/ideas into action. Just spell that sspuniversity.com, but it's university, but spell university.com/ideas into action. sspuniversity.com/ideas into action. If you want to be not just a better researcher, but also more persuasive, take a look at how you can learn from pros, okay? From pros, how to win hearts and mind. Who are pros? Brett, who do you think is a pro? I'll name 5, okay? Scott Hambrick, quickly becoming one of my favorite podcasters. He was on the show a couple weeks ago. Jay Dyer, who just had a really spectacular debate with Stefan Molyneux. I encourage you all to go watch that. Kevin Geary, who gives a presentation called How to Sell an Idea to the People You Want to Influence in 10 Steps. Don't you love it when things are broken into easy-to-follow steps? We do that. Michael Malice, Tom Woods. And if you go to this website and you look at the full list, you're like, wow, how did he not mention this name? This is one of my favorite guys. Please go check it out, sspuniversity.com/ideas into action. And if you look at the price and you go, that's too much money, email me, brett@schoolsucksproject.com, all caps, too much money. You can use the word money or you can just do dollar signs, as long as it's all caps. I will have a conversation with you about how you can get a discount while helping your favorite content creator presenting at the summit. That's like a win-win-win situation. I win, you win, and your favorite presenter wins. So please don't sleep on that opportunity. Brett@schoolsucksproject.com. Too much money. All right. Please look at the show notes and follow The Honest Teacher on Facebook. This is also a great reservoir of videos and memes that you could share to do better outreach on the school problem and the self-directed learning solution. Just search Facebook for The Honest Teacher. You'll find the page. It's a popular one. All right. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back on Wednesday. Here we go. Hello there.
How's it going, Brett?
I don't even know what your name is.
That's true. I usually do everything kind of just anonymously, but you can call me Jay for short. But yeah, on everything on the page, it's just, you know, done through the Honest Teacher branding.
Right. So I said to you, in just like the 2 minutes that we talked before we started, I said, I want to go into this completely blind. I've never started an interview before without knowing somebody's name, but we'll call you Jay. So, Jay, you are a teacher.
Not currently. I was recently in the past. I had taught for several years and finished that up in 2016. But I still do work with young people like you in the past as a tutoring company owner.
So how long did you teach for?
I taught for 3 years. I taught high school and middle school.
Yeah. I think if that's the time that you're going to get honest, if you're going to get real about what's going on there, it's probably going to happen in those first 5 years, right?
Yeah.
Before the system really gets its hooks into you. And, you know, I think that I was lucky doing the work the way I was doing it and being so early in my career, I was able to just encounter the right information at the right time and have the realizations that I did on my own. But I want to hear all about your story. You had 3 years of experience. What were you teaching? As much as you can tell us about the kind of environment you were working in, I'd love to hear about that as well.
Sure. So if you don't mind, I'm going to take it all the way back,
Please. Really
far back.
Yes.
Even further back than that, because I think by the time I go through the history, you'll be even more intrigued.
Start with the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah. So my story in terms of thinking about the nature of schooling and its effects on young people goes back actually to my own father, who actually was also a 30-year veteran New York City school teacher. Mm. And he was a contemporary to Gatto, teaching at the same time. And he got to see many of the major transitions that took place within the schools toward, you know, tyranny and really controlling on people's lives. In fact, at the school he was teaching at, they were one of the first in the 80s to get metal detectors, SROs, that is the school resource officers, drug dogs, and things like that.
Yeah.
And so he got the full view change of things that started to take place in the 70s and 80s. And I got to see some of that myself as well, because I was actually, you know, attending private schools. My parents, you know, wanted to send me there and not to public schools. My dad being a public school teacher and all knowing how bad it was.
What part of the city, by the way?
He worked in a middle school that brought in young people from all around the area. So, you know, this was, I guess you could say, a big change that started to take place with education at that time. Is that as opposed to having K-8 schools where, you know, young people kind of were all together until they got up to the upper levels, you know, by and large, there was a changeover where they started to separate, that is, you know, state bureaucrats started to separate schools into segments, right? You have elementary now, you have middle, you have high schools. And, you know, in seeing that, my dad also commented on the fact that by separating out kids on those demographics, you know, basically those age groups, it actually further caused violent conflict and bullying, because he said that when they switched over, instead of having young kids around, you know, these, you know, developing teens, where there would still be a sense of empathy and, you know, kind of like being a bigger brother or sister to kids, you know, around them.
Sure.
That they would, you know, start to try to show hierarchy with each other, you know, who's, you know, the most important, most powerful, you know, from all these different schools they come into, you know, from different areas where, you know, they're all bused into. And so that was, you know, a very intriguing change. But, you know, my father was, you know, teaching through that, mostly physical science, health education, you know, biological science and things like that. So I got to see what that was like to be at that kind of facility, because with the bring your kid to work day, my dad would bring me along. A couple of times, you know, when I was, you know, basically just around the pre-teens arena in the late 90s. And, you know, I got to see what was completely shocking to me, which, you know, was foreign. This idea that all these kids were like rounded up in these big concrete buildings with, you know, gated fences, and they all had to go through metal detectors, and there was like police there and stuff. I'm like, okay, this is really... this is really scary. It just really feels like a prison that you're going into.
And with all this authoritarian control inside it, you still have these Lord of the Flies style social interactions, it sounds like, from what you're describing. Which I always, you know, I always read Lord of the Flies. I was talking about this with a couple guys recently, as a book that's not really a great book, but it's in, you know, every school reading program as like, see what could happen. But the school environment creates its own version of that. So it sounds like you're describing that to some degree.
Absolutely. And I, from my experience as well, which I'll get into as well, I completely agree that doing that, that is taking kids out of their familiar environments, segregating them away from, you know, a diverse, you know, group of people, you know, all ages interaction, removes the empathetic element of, you know, being able to learn from and mentor other, you know, people, that is younger people, and hits them against each other in this kind of competitive hierarchy of like, okay, who's the biggest dog in the sixth, seventh, eighth grade kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
So I definitely, you know, would corroborate that from my own experience as well. And, you know, that was kind of my first glimpses into, or, you know, thoughts about the nature of at least public school and how scary and authoritarian it can seem, especially compared to, you know, well, it wasn't, you know, not authoritarian, just more cushy and relaxed private school, you know, compared to what these kids were going through. But I personally didn't really take much of an interest in teaching myself directly, you know, even though my father was a teacher and, it was, you know, learning was just kind of like a part of life. And my mom was really big into, you know, always being creative and thoughtful and learning things like that. I didn't really take a look into that until much later as a thought of, oh, maybe I should, you know, teach or something like that. When I was in undergrad, I, you know, went to a major national university that's, you know, very good and all those accolades and things like that. And, you know, in high school, I was a straight A student, you know, model student, didn't really get into trouble, you know, by and large, mm-hmm. at least on the books. And, you know, just was doing the whole signaling thing, you know, just thinking, oh, okay, well, it feels good to get good grades. And, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. And, you know, if you do that, that's what will get you success. And, you know, I was studying different things in college, ended up, you know, focusing more on business and public relations, and then eventually took that after to another national university for law school, and was studying in law school juvenile justice, criminal defense, and some entertainment law. And that started to propel me in the direction of working with young people because of my focus with juvenile defense and juvenile issues.
Yeah.
And I actually worked as a juvenile defense attorney, and I got to learn a lot about, you know, how children are treated there too, in terms of the school to prison pipeline, and see young people even in, you know, you could say classrooms within juvenile detention halls. So you have kids in orange jumpsuits still going to school with, you know, the big flag hanging, and, you know, they're still keeping up with their history lessons or whatever else, you know, they're indoctrinating them with, even while they're waiting for, you know, arraignment or trial.
Okay. Yeah. This is really interesting because this was a big, that working with that population was a big turning point in my whole worldview too. I was very, I think, like big P progressive coming out of college and, you know, really believed not just the state, but those systems, the state support and taxpayer support could really be good custodians of these kinds of kids. And, you know, what was sad is that I hate to say it, but some of them came from environments that were so bad that new environment was almost like a respite in some cases. And I know public school is for certain kids as well. But one thing that I realized is just how lost in this downward spiral of that system so many kids became. And there was this determinism that comes with diagnoses, not just like, you know, psychological or behavioral, you're on this meds or you're diagnosed with this disorder, but also the diagnoses from the criminal justice system. A lot of kids just seeking, you know, visibility or attention or comfort or whatever it was, and landing themselves in all these this trouble, and then not being able to get out of it. Like one kid saying to me, "I'm already bad." That was what he said when he was just, you know, he was on probation. He was going to wind up back in some detention facility. He had been out. He was going to this day school that I worked at. It was really confronting work, and it took a lot of the enthusiasm I had for the job out of me very quickly in just a matter of a couple of years. So you're a fairly young man doing this work. What's its impact on you as you were, you know, going through being a juvenile defense attorney?
Sure. So just kind of piggybacking off of what you said in terms of, you know, the how young people are treated within the criminal justice system, I definitely saw how, in a large part, the way that judges treated young people was definitely from a bent of obedience to the schooling system. School was itself almost this kind of crux or focus. It was this idea that in order to be, you know, better or good, you know, child, you needed to have good grades. And whenever they were going through the process, they were always checking in with their social workers on their grades and how they're doing in school and things like that. And a lot of cases, you know, revolved around incidents with school, truancy issues, and the like. And for me, it made it very clear that the nature of compulsory schooling and pushing young people through, you know, based on this kind of one-size-fits-all progression, just further hinders young people's development who are already struggling. So this idea that, oh, you know, public school is this kind of salvation place for the kids who don't have good parents or who are otherwise struggling or they're not getting enough food, in my opinion, from what I saw, it was actually the opposite. If you were already lacking support, if you already had struggles, you were going to be the most likely to be stigmatized, selected out, bullied, and told there's something wrong with you.
And it's not an environment where you can be useful. You know, like if your use is to be there and be a bucket for people to put information in and then pour your bucket back out onto a test or whatever kind of assessment. And yeah, I was just talking about this in a recent show. I think I was being interviewed on another show. And I said, I know what it's like to take that distress. I mean, even if you think like you're not 100% on your game as an adult trying to learn something, you got stuff on your mind, something's nagging you, you're not in optimal learning conditions as like a well-adjusted adult. You know, I know what that's like. I saw so many of these kids bringing these issues in from home when I worked at a day school. And I remember like the times when they would come back from vacation, like Christmas or something. So they would actually go home to some kind of family situation. And then it was like 2 weeks of decompression and readjustment from what they had encountered while they were there. So as soon as they get back there, they're expected to conform to the expectations of that environment. In school, it's just like, it's got to be such a roller coaster where their home environments can be so chaotic, and then they have to come in the next day and try to play the part of a student. And of course, then they're labeled and diagnosed and disciplined for not being able to do that. And obviously, they wouldn't be able to do that. I mean, it's bad enough kids coming to school after watching cartoons and eating sugar in the morning, you know? I mean, imagine like a really chaotic, you know, domestic situation. It's tough.
Absolutely. And yeah, I just agree with you there that fundamentally, these concepts of, oh, you know, schooling and like social services, that by intertwining them, it's actually done the opposite in terms of helping young people. Because what happens is by making, you know, school is like, this is the normal thing you're supposed to do and you have to do this, it's setting them up for failure. Because obviously, if you're hungry and you have dysfunctional home life and things are rough, you're not getting enough sleep, you're not going to do as well in your day to day. You're going to have a shorter temper. You're going to be more likely to react if you're getting bullied in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I personally saw that both as an attorney and as a teacher. So, you know, these are very serious issues that I think, you know, people have to really wrap their minds around of what actually happens at the end of the day. And, you know, for one kind of interesting example, I was at a district meeting with other teachers, you know, within the school district for a training. And one teacher told me that at a poor school that she was at, that one child came in with, you could say, kind of like plastic grocery bags, things that, you know, you'd get out of, you know, grocery store for underwear. That's how poor this child was and their family was. And I was like, it seems like as if in terms of the priorities, you know, getting out of poverty might be more of an issue than being like, oh, I got to, you know, read something about this random story and turn it in by Friday. Otherwise, they're going to say something's wrong with me, you know. So it was, you know, she was like, you know, kind of engaged by that. But it really is a reminder that there is a wide degree of difference between what is being done with school and actually meaningfully helping young people who are in distress.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I learned about like Maslow's hierarchy of needs as a history teacher, because I remember like talking like to another teacher at the school I worked at being really frustrated, like I'm doing this important work of trying to teach these kids history, and how like lofty a priority that actually is compared to like where their real unmet needs were. And it was amazing that somebody like me, who was so ignorant to that, even after years of having that experience, that just how unprepared they were to hear anything that I said. in that classroom, that somebody like me was allowed around kids, but there's lots of people like me and worse that are allowed around these kids. And I think that participates in the problem that we're starting to discuss here. But these kids had such fundamental needs in both environments where I worked, and even with, you know, more affluent populations, you know, all kinds of emotional needs that weren't met. And those kids had to get A's because that was the expectation of them. Like these kids with that determinism in the boarding school, academics didn't matter. But, you know, what I witnessed across all populations, which was also a real wake up for me this was happening like 2006, 2007, was this silent suffering across like all young people and for a lot of the same general reasons too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, just kind of continuing off of that and just, you know, thinking through that, I was, you know, starting to become kind of frustrated with the nature of the juvenile justice system. I just saw how there really was no meaningful help being offered to young people. You know, they'd have counselors, they do community service and this or that, but there really wasn't a meaningful long-term help to young people in terms of changing what needs weren't being met. I mean, and I even saw, like, for example, one woman brought in her 9-year-old in front of the court. I was just like, I can't even take care of this kid. I need help. Like, you know what I mean? We're talking about very desperate people mm-hmm. who are just begging for help. And, you know, this manner of thinking about young people, you know, through this lens of, okay, well, we just need to get them to conform to the right things and then everything will be fine. You know, and that right thing is school. It's really difficult to watch and to see that kind of same process get repeated over. And when I was, you know, in this line of work, things were not going too well overall because of, you know, the economic downturn after, you know, the housing market crash and all other stuff. And so I was starting to think about other things I could do potentially, you know, just bring in some more money, diversify my income and things like that. And an ex at the time had suggested maybe I should do some substitute teaching as well, just to, like, you know, get out there, do something. And I was like, well, that could be interesting. So I, you know, did substitute teaching training, and, you know, it was very difficult in terms of, there's a lot of cronyism often in those systems. That's another thing I, you know, could speak to is that
cronyism and substitute teaching.
Yeah. So in other words, within the system that I was in, and, you know, heard from others as well, there is favoritism for certain people, right? So even in getting substitute teachers, you really had to kind of just be the squeaky wheel to get in because they would give preferences to like different people who were connected or like, you know, demographically connected and stuff like that. So it was definitely tough to even get into substitute teaching, but eventually I made my way in there and I, you know, started with just taking whatever came along. I, you know, do some middle schools, some high schools, whatever topics, you know, got to see all kinds of interesting situations. Like in one rough school, like the kids who I was working with started like writing their, you know, gang symbols up on the board. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. You know, but all kinds of people you can imagine. And I enjoyed it in that I was working with young people, but I, you know, again, I was still seeing a lot of the same patterns where, you know, fundamentally, these young people were just being treated, you know, as objects just to be like, okay, you know, do whatever it takes to just keep them controlled and, you know, pass it on. And, you know, it was something that was, again, you know, starting to like really weigh on my consciousness, but I still was like, okay, well, maybe, you know, there's a path for me here that, you know, I can make a difference or do something otherwise, something like that. So I decided to get certified and do the teaching thing. So I ended up getting certified in 6-12 English education, 6-12 math education, 6-12 business education. And an opportunity came along where a teacher had gotten cancer. So they had to leave, and it was at the beginning of the year because they had to go through special treatments. So I was able to take over their role, and I was, you know, teaching English classes. And I was also teaching, I don't know if you heard of this program called ACE. It's basically University of Cambridge program. So I had to get certified by University of Cambridge to teach it. But it's kind of a critical thinking skills course. So I was doing that as well.
Okay.
Which is itself another interesting thing.
Before we go any further with that, I just want to jump back to you being a substitute. And are you still in New York City at this point?
No. I wasn't in New York City doing this stuff. So no, this wasn't in New York.
Okay. But was it a city or like a large metro area?
It was in an area that had, you could say, a pretty big population, but not quite city, not quite, you know, like New York style or LA or something like that.
But what you were finding is you were going to vastly different types of schools and working with vastly different populations. What was that like? I mean, I'm trying to sympathize with that as like in the early days of my career, I wasn't subbing, but I would float. Like when I moved from being like a residential worker when I was in college at this boarding school and I wanted to be in education. So I agreed to float. And I never knew, like I'd get up in the morning at 6 to have to be there at like 7:30. And I never knew what I was going to be involved in that day.
Right.
And I just remember the anxiety about that. I was probably 21. So what was that like to get the call in the morning and to like just to be in the habit of not knowing where you're going to go or what you're going to deal with?
I mean, for me, it was fine. I had a lot of fun with it. I think for me, it was relatively easy because the system I was in, they had online listings and you could like check them in the morning, like I wake up a certain time and like see what's open. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I'd find schools that I really liked and just, you know, got in touch with their, you know, you could say a principal or principal secretary and said, hey, you know, if you hear good things about me, just call me back. And, you know, got personal with them, gave them a card. And then I'd get more direct calls or like more longer term things. So, you know what I mean? If they knew a teacher was going to be out for a week or 2 weeks or, you know, something that they knew was coming up, they'd hit me up for that. So, yeah, I mean, it was fun, you know, the excitement of being like, oh, I wonder where I'm going to be today. And, I worked my way to like start to build relationships and eventually, you know, get more steady locations. But yeah, before that I was whatever came up, you know, whether it's like more of a hood school or like more of a nice school, just was whatever came up. I just did it. So.
Well, it certainly sounds like you had the right attitude about it, right? This will be fun. I'm excited to see where I'm going to go. Yeah, I like that. So now you're certified in your story. You're teaching English. You have a semi-permanent position, meaning that it's no longer a sub role, or I guess a long-term sub role. This is your first like actual year of teaching. So what are the discoveries during this time?
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like like you already came into this with much more knowledge about the reality of the system just from watching your father's experience and from the juvenile justice experience, that you're much more attuned to like the harsh realities of what's happening here. And so this is not, I don't want to say the typical teacher wake up story because it almost never happens. Teachers almost never do this, but it is typical in that it happens early in a person's career if it happens at all. So that's definitely you. You're primed to spot and probably through your work motivated to solve or at least mitigate some of these problems that you know about. So that kind of sets the stage for the beginning of your career.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, coming into it, I definitely had some experience and, you know, obviously I'd worked with young people as a substitute teacher and as a juvenile defense attorney. So definitely had a little bit more general understanding of things to expect and things to navigate. But even then, it's still always exciting to, you know, see what was going to happen and deal with, you know, even at a nicer high school, which is where I was at. It was an 8A high school. So it was a very large, you know, student population over 2000. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd have a student, you know, tell me to go F myself and stuff like that because they were mad that I took over for the teacher they liked.
Yeah.
You know, and little things like that, interesting things, which I didn't, you know, care about. It didn't bother me. I wouldn't take it personally. But it had its own challenges, you know, dealing with, you know, people in that. And I had, you know, both regular classes and advanced classes. So I got to see, you know, the bottom of things, you know what I mean? With, you know, in terms of like, okay, here's like the regular run of the mill class that nobody, you know, in terms of institutionally cares about. And they just want to graduate. They just want to get out of there. They're excited to get out. And then like the students who are like the super high achievers, like really want to go to, you know, Harvard and stuff like that. So it was a lot of fun to be able to just kind of see a wide range of young people and be able to, you know, talk with them, work with them. And also because when I was at the high school, they're a bit older, I was able to talk more about like bigger picture topics and things like that, especially through the ACE program. Because I think it's something that you might appreciate because I know you like, you know, Trivium and things like that. The ACE program actually has, you know, kind of a critical thinking skills course. And this thing called Global Perspectives, where they apply critical thinking skills and, you know, discuss big picture issues.
So it's like an integrated study kind of program?
Yeah, it's kind of like international baccalaureate where they have special things you do for graduation requirements to get the diploma, and they have an ACE diploma, but it's just University of Cambridge.
All right.
And there's some things I enjoyed personally in there. But of course, as with anything, I also catch the manipulations and the things they throw in there to get young people to buy into central planning, climate alarmism, and other stuff like that. That, you know, is this idea that they still want them to graduate with like total belief in the government is, you know, your savior and the solution for everything. So, you know what I mean? Like, even though there's some critical thinking skills and real tactics and tools they put in there, there's edge cases where you see them not applying the critical thinking skills. Like, they don't have the robust discussion.
Right. Really, I don't mind if we tangent on this. So recently, again, I was being interviewed on another show, and I was talking about outcomes-based education. And when I was doing a radio show maybe like 7 years ago, somebody submitted to us as show prep, like, Texas legislature, wants to eliminate critical thinking from curriculum. And, you know, my thinking was, this is too good to be true. First of all, critical thinking isn't in the curriculum. Politicians wouldn't publicly try to eliminate it if it was. So what's the story here? And what it found out, it was probably reported by, you know, a non-conservative website with that slant. But what they were actually after was a part of outcomes-based education where critical thinking had just been repurposed as, you know, like parroting back the most responsible or the views deemed most responsible. If you think like us, the people who create this curriculum, you are thinking critically because obviously we do. But it sounds like what you're talking about has, like, even though that's happening, and I think that's a function of the environment, you also have actual explicit training in, like, the principles of critical thinking in the ACE program.
Yes. And that, I think, is very different from even AP or IB, is that, and I was shocked to see it, but I was, of course, happy.
Yeah.
They actually, in their critical thinking skills course, do cover inductive and deductive reasoning, Raven analysis, statistical framing bias, and other things like that, where you're actually, you know, talking about the mechanics of what to look for in terms of seeing if there's a bias, how to see if there's an actual logical deduction taking place. So impressively enough, they do have that in there. But as with what you could imagine for any type of formally government instituted curriculum, there's always going to be soft spots where they're going to make assertions or intentionally only cover or frame an issue from a certain bent to kind of get you to that preconceived idea of what they want in terms of the outcome,
which is
unfortunate.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. What about fallacies?
Yep. Logical fallacies is a part of the critical thinking skills class as well. And they cover all the foundational ones you could imagine, you know, whatever you could think of, like Texas sharpshooter, ad hominem, or no true Scotsman, bandwagon, you name it. You know, they cover, you know, biases in terms of like glittering generalities and all that other stuff, like, you know, ways to manipulate language. So they do. It's actually, I thought it was pretty cool that they actually covered that. Of course, again, how I presented it may have not been even what I think the creators of the program wanted, of course, because I actually made sure that, that they had robust discussions and things like that. But it's still just a reminder that at the end of the day, the discourse is always going to be narrowly tailored and focused on whatever it is that those in control of the system want them to believe in the day. So, saw that there too.
So it's like the trivium when the grammar is unquestionable, right? Like there's no debating the grammar. Go ahead and work with it logically. And you see a lot of people making these definitional errors or definitional oversights, and they never really dig into what things actually mean or what things are actually about. And their logic can be flawless. They can commit not one fallacy, but they're not checking premises. And it sounds like that is a function of this program that you're talking about.
Right. That's a potential there that can happen based on what I've read. Because, you know, obviously I read through the whole curriculum and took a look at, you know, how they wanted you to frame things. And certainly that, you know, that could arise.
Yeah. You getting in trouble because were you asking them to check more premises?
No, I didn't really get into any kind of trouble because there was nothing to check on or anything like that with me.
You know,
I had relative autonomy within that class. The young people who are in it, there's, you know what I mean? There's nothing really to, like, I guess, nitpick over for them because a lot, again, this is only for students who are already in an accelerated program. So it's like they want to be their kind of thing. Like they're the overachiever, you know, want to, you know, get the diploma kind of thing. So, Right. Yeah. So, you know what I mean? So I didn't face too much, but you know, it was a lot of fun to be able to talk with them about it. But of course, you know, at least this at how the University of Cambridge would like it presented, there's limitations there that I tried to, you know, come around and circumvent.
Did anybody ever express concern or dissatisfaction with anything that you were doing related to your management of it?
In terms of coverage of topics, not directly. I would say mostly the biggest complaints I got was because, again, at the time I was, you know, acting in an authoritarian role, and I, you know, of course, don't agree with those actions that I did, and I, you know, I do regret that. But it would be like I would actually edit their papers and give them feedback and say this needs to be changed. And you know, I'm not talking about like substantive, like, oh, you have to change the position of your paper. I'm saying like just language, you know, use and writing. And they would, you know, get mad at me because, and this is of course not going to be surprising to you, they had just been passed along their whole life, right?
Sure.
And that's a part of what is today. Right now, the teachers who are in the schools, the survivors, I would say, because as you, I think, aptly know, most teachers with a conscience are going to leave within 5 years, and that's true. The ones who survive these days, the ones who are riding out to their pension days, have figured out that the best thing to do is just to pass them along, because if they don't rock the boat, and as long as they get the grades and stuff like that, and they get the graduation rates, they get the funding, they don't get the scrutiny, and it's just not worth the hassle to battle the students on grades. Now, again, this isn't to say that, you know, I like grading, because I don't. This isn't to say I like compulsory schooling, but just by their own standards, again, the compulsory schooling paradigm standards, it's all a farce at this point from what I've seen and what I've heard from, of course, many different, you know, people who are teaching across many different states. It's all the same. At the mainstream public school level, virtually all students are getting passed along for the sake of graduation rates and numbers. And because, you know, principals put pressure on them to literally make sure that they get good grades. And I actually had that experience personally. My grades that I had for certain students were changed behind my back.
It's, you know, it's children's shoes in the Soviet Union. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Like, shoe factories got shoe quotas, you know? How do you make 10,000 pairs of shoes a month? You make them in size 4, right?
Yeah.
So you got adult shoe shortages. That's actually semi-poetic, that analogy. But I didn't really see much of that in my career, but I've certainly heard the stories, and obviously the trend over the last... I don't know. I would say 50 years. I think there's lots of people who criticize public schools, like Peg Luksic, Charlotte Iserby, Sam Blumenfeld before he passed away, that and Gatto didn't go for this so much, but they believed that there was like a golden age of American public school. But I'm not really sure what they're talking about, because it was after the installation of the Prussian system and after the progressive reform movement in a lot of cases.
Right.
Like I was just mentioning Peg Luksic talking about romanticizing like the 1950s of public education.
Right.
But even the ones who kind of point to like the progressive era and the influence of people like John Dewey and all the academics that kind of circled around him, they see schooling before that, like latter half of the 19th century schooling, as in a really positive light. And I think the dumbing down has always existed, even though the degree of it in the last 50 or so years has been turned up. And I think that is really the case with Common Core, which is more geared to the service industry. But if you think about absolving people of personal responsibility, individual identity, and critical thinking, which has been the mission of compulsory schooling since the Prussians, you know, initiated it in the second decade of the 1800s. Or if not even before that in some places, yeah, it's dumbing down from the start. And I think a lot of people have failed to, they say, oh, what happened? You know, when I went to school in the 70s, it was great. It wasn't,
right.
You know, trust me.
Right. And I completely agree. And if I may have an opinion on that as to what you're saying in terms of like that halcyon days of, you know, past school, I think that what they saw was that in that time period, the school day was a lot shorter. They didn't have, you know, all these other crazy electives, and it wasn't like this whole child learning policy. And because there wasn't mass media that we have today in terms of the prevalence, I think for many young people, school may have actually been exciting to the extent that it was new information and friends that, you know, you come out of, you know, maybe more rural areas and people you can meet. There wasn't as much time spent in the classroom. It was much shorter. And you kind of focused on some just, you know, basic skills, reading, arithmetic, some history and things like that. And otherwise, you know, there was more relative freedom, of course.
Yeah,
you know, with your day, you could be a young person and literally have a shotgun in your truck and go, you know, hunting after school, or you could, you know, do whatever. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there wasn't all this like micromanagement, I think, that we have today in terms of the existing public school paradigm. And I definitely want to talk about that as well. And shift has taken place into something that is truly Orwellian, a true totalitarian kind of 1984 control of young people.
Okay, so that is coming up. I would just like you to, you know, run through. So we're talking about the first year of teaching, and I'd like you to line that up with, you know, the years that follow, the beginning of your online project, The Honest Teacher, how those two overlap, if they do, and then we'll get into this Orwellian world of today.
Perfect. So going from the high school experience there, you know, obviously I enjoyed it enough to kind of stay around. It was like, okay, maybe I'll keep teaching for a little bit. Maybe there's some other opportunities. And I went to apply to teach at that school that I've been teaching at, you know, within another role, and got, you could say, I didn't get the position because they put another person who was there for another program they had. In other words, there was a bit of favoritism because they were married to another teacher and they like wanted to have them for their special role. So even though they weren't really good at that area, they just stuck them in there anyway. So I was like, oh, okay. And there's that too, you know, between, you know, changing my grades behind my back and putting in someone else, you know, when they weren't the best person for the role because they want to like move people around in the system kind of thing. I was like, I was a little annoyed at that. But I had applied to some other places that were way more prestigious and more up my alley. Mm-hmm. And one school was a top 100 nationally ranked high school. And I ended up turning them down because I just didn't want to drive to like where they were. It was a little bit far and they were like a big murder capital. So I'm like, no, I'm good. So I ended up deciding to settle at a K-8 middle school. And I thought that it'd be a little bit more manageable too with younger people because, you know, with high schoolers, naturally they get into more, you could say, behind the scenes abusive tactics, right? Like if they don't like you, which some of them just didn't like the fact that I was taking over for a teacher they liked kind of thing, you know, they try to like do something to you on social media or say stuff and this or that. I was like, well, at least maybe, you know, the middle schoolers won't be as bad or vindictive, or, you know, some of them would like, oh, I could go through so many stories, but like, you know, some would like clearly like smoke, you know, a bong in the car and like come in and like breathe. And you're like, okay, really? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like those kinds of things that come up a little bit more often, you know, and just didn't want to maybe deal with that as much. Thought maybe a little younger would be more manageable. So I ended up going to this K-8 public charter school that, you know, was, you know, in terms of the public appearance, you know, well-ranked, you know, A-rated school year after year kind of thing, competitive and stuff like that. And I was teaching math, you know, across the spectrum, kind of, you know, everything from sixth grade intensive to students who are in geometry honors because they are double advanced. And during that time, especially, is where I got to get in deep and see just how you could say abusive the schooling system is toward young people in those formative years. Because now I had this really kind of like organic from the bottom insight, being able to be where there's kindergartners all the way up through eighth grade to see what's actually going on, what's taking place, how students are treated, how they're controlled and how they're, you know, managed. Across the board.
Yeah.
And so during this time, you know, is when I got to really see how young children are indoctrinated to keep in line. For example, using things like color sticks. I don't know if you've ever seen anything like that, where like they have behavior sticks that they hold up to like shame kids and keep them in line.
Who like, holds them up? The other students hold them up?
The teacher would usually hold them up, although I have seen another student lead a line and hold it once, but usually it's a teacher that holds it.
Okay, tell me all about color sticks. I've never heard of this.
Okay. Well, then we'll talk about all these different tactics, right? So obviously, you know, you probably have heard of like writing on the board names and stuff like that to like shame students or be like, oh, so you're in trouble. Like, you know, first step, second step, third step kind of thing. But color sticks are a very popular modern tactic, especially in the elementary arena, where your behavior is graded on a scale. And they have your name on a little clip and they will move you on the totem pole as relative to everybody else on the totem pole and hold that around as a constant visual reminder of where you are. And of course, what's that going to do to young kids? It's going to put them into a sense of, you know, worthlessness and feeling all or nothing. I'm all good or all bad.
Especially when your perspective of the world is so small, right? Like school's your whole, I mean, it's not the whole world, but it's a huge part of your world. Like it really takes over your life when you enter elementary school, right? Like it is the way from that point on. And I also realized that there was a real connection between like helplessness and treatment. And this goes back to like when you're talking about all the way to the juvenile justice system and that population of people, a lot of those people, you know, they're dependent on government for housing, for food, and those systems treat them worse because of that socioeconomic dynamic. And here, and I saw that firsthand with the populations that I worked with as well. So here, it's just that helplessness is from age. And I noticed that when I was working with like, you know, a vast range of ages in private education, that it seemed like the mistreatment. Okay. Mistreatment is a fair word, was more prevalent where people could get away with it. You know, now I understand that you're talking about something that's actually systematized, that's actually approved. So it's a little bit different, but in a way that makes me way more upset that this is like an accepted, this isn't somebody going rogue. This is policy that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's just a common classroom tactic that I've seen implemented in many different places, of course, including the school that I was working at. And it was just one of many things that I saw that I, you know, as I was going through, just putting all the pieces together to really observe the specifics of how young people are browbeaten into submission and into feelings of worthlessness. And just, you know, watching the teachers often yell at them and scream at the kids, you know, have them walk in, you know, ordered lines, then keep them silent for, you know, testing. And that's a whole other thing I can get into in terms of how testing and the growth of testing has really affected kids. But, you know, it's just a constant sense of, you know, rushing from one thing to the next thing while being yelled at and while being shamed. And, you know, it was very disheartening to see that was not only, you know, prevalent practice, but was just viewed with nonchalance. That's just, oh, of course,
like, exactly.
You know, they're kids, you got to yell at them. You got to, you know, scream at them if they're doing something you don't like. You know, you got to, you know, keep them in line and make sure they know where they are. You know, it's very sad to see that. And when it came to my own experiences, because again, I wasn't working directly with the elementary kids. I would just, you know, see them and see other teachers and meet with other teachers for different things. My, you know, focus was on the middle school. But, you know, even there, I think I got to really dive in deep and see how they are being impacted in terms of their self-worth with what technology is out there today. And for me, this is one of the biggest paradigm shifts that I've seen, is that now that young people have basically 100% uptime a view of their grades, because everything's now digitized and everything's, you know, on demand. You just sign in, see everything. So many young people now are constantly being monitored for their grades moment to moment, you know, by parents, by teachers and things like that. And being shaved, like, why isn't this done? You know, even though the teacher just hasn't even put it in yet kind of thing. Like it becomes this cycle where the saving time of having things digital has actually ended up becoming kind of digital tyranny, where young people are constantly being compared, even to the point where, and this was true at the high school and other students I've worked with, that they have rankings, ordered rankings, right? Of you know, where do you fall within your class? You know, what number are you? Mm-hmm. And it's updated, you know, digitally, automatically based on your grades moment to moment.
Right. So the end of my career was the beginning of this. And I saw the stress or like the nervousness that it was causing parents to just have regular access to this information. And it definitely, I mean, I was working at the end of my career doing the tutoring. I mean, I was in like the greater Boston area. It was very wealthy, a lot of kids trying to get into Ivy League schools. And then I, you know, ran a tutoring company in a wealthy part of New Hampshire that was geared towards getting kids the test scores they needed for top tier higher education. So I saw a really hovering population, and I definitely remember this development. You know, this my work ran from maybe like 2006-ish to 2014. So that was, it's a totally different world today. If I went back to this, I know I would encounter like a totally new world, but I saw that transition and I saw the anxiety that it caused for sure.
And absolutely. And that's exactly what it's causing, is it's causing anxiety on an unprecedented level, where, you know, in the past you had paper report cards and that was it. You know, you just saw the teachers would fill in their grades just before the quarters. You might get a progress report and then you'd have, you know, your semester grades. But now, I mean, it's kids are constantly being threatened and shamed. And sadly, unfortunately, the parents are complicit in this by their own families, because now there's no understanding from them. They just, you know what I mean? They just see something they think is missing, or why is this zero? And it's, again, it's not even the kid's fault. It's just the teacher didn't update it, or they just, you know, put in zeros or something like that until they were going to update something. And I've watched that happen time and again, of that constant stress and shame being put on students. That, I mean, I definitely would not be happy about that, you know,
right?
That constant pressure. And coupled with that is, of course, the digital technology they're using, that to me, you know, there's many different issues, of course, with both, you know, the tracking and, you know, how it's being used. But fundamentally, in the past, you could get away with kind of skimming things and, you know, kind of just paying attention to class, right? Not having to study maybe outside as much, you know, or get away with reading homework and things like that. Now everything's digital and they have digital check-ins for everything, right? So the kid who would be like, yeah, I kind of just skim this and wing it and do all right and get, you know, still have a free life somewhat by just paying a little attention to class.
Yeah.
You can't even do that anymore. Because now if you don't click every button and fill in every field and fill in every form on your digital homework, on your reading assignments and other things like that, you don't get the credit.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's like, there's no escape. These kids are being, you know, monitored digitally and constantly being shamed. Their assignments and their work is 100%, you know, basically tracked in many, you know, cases, you know, the digitized math, digitized, you know, English reading, digitized civics. I mean, I've seen it all. I've seen digitization in pretty much every field. And if you skimp out on anything, they know, because again, it's tracked.
Right.
So there's no outlet. There's no little bit of, as you said, respite for kids who maybe are a little bit, you know, more advanced in their reading or understanding and kind of like maybe give themselves a break.
Yeah.
Just paying a little bit of attention.
Right. You know, yeah. I think we've all had like a customer service experience where we need help or we need something changed. And we go to the guy or the gal and they say something like, sorry, company policy. Sorry, it's a computer. I can't override this. I don't have access, whatever it is, right? We've heard those kinds of things. Now, school, by the very nature of the environment, favors compliance over accommodation, right? So as a student or even as a parent advocating for a child, which doesn't happen enough, you know, like I've always said that parents have this tendency unconsciously to become the policemen or enforcers for the school. Even I, as a tutor, who thought I was this cool, young, like, I get that school sucks. I mean, that was me in like 2006, 2007. I became an enforcer, right? Like, I'm here because you have a C. You know, so
right.
Now with what you're talking about, the possibility for negotiation was always low. Now it sounds like in a lot of these cases, it's nil. Like I remember 10 years ago, you know, going and talking to a teacher about this kid who had like a really, really high aptitude in math. And for some reason, he was just in like a mid-level elementary school math class. And I said, this is boring this kid to death. And she said, I don't care. He just needs to do what I say, because he wouldn't show his work. The game of it for him was to do all the work in his head, right? he would demonstrate this for me. And I was like, how hard is it to demonstrate this for a teacher or a guidance counselor or in a school meeting? But it never happened. And ultimately, the mom's response was, well, I guess he has to do what this teacher says. This teacher who fails to like view him as an individual or accommodate him or contemplate anything other than conformity and compliance, I guess we have to do what that person says because that's the teacher. That was like the golden age of negotiation. Now, if I'm hearing you correctly, it sounds like we're way further removed from that because of this technology.
Well, certainly in terms of just the digital technology marking students down, I think it still also has to be paired with the fact that at least, especially in the high school level, that many teachers fib their grades. Like, I mean, again, they're a long-term teacher. They're engaging in some fibbing these days because they just want them to pass along. And I actually have seen that more often than anything else. But again, where is this really crushing young people, right? Mm-hmm. Elementary and middle, because they're the ones who are being ramped up on this digital technology. It's being held against them, right? And again, it's like these little kids and they're sitting there saying, what's wrong with you? You can't sit for hours and go through this, you know, digital navigation thing and do these tests. I mean, it really is mind boggling when you like wrap your mind around this and like think about, wait a second, you're saying this to this kid who like clearly they're not developmentally ready for even this, even if they wanted to at some point. Like it really is kind of self-defeating what they've implemented, that is, you know, the people within the public school administration, what they've implemented to try to, you know, modernize and, you know, make 21st century learning within schools. It really ends up crushing young people. And a part of that, of course, in the crushing process that I've seen is the push for young people to get diagnosed with some type of disability so that they can get IEPs or 504 plans, which if anybody's not familiar, just listening, those are special federally mandated programs that if someone has a diagnosed disability, they get accommodations. And
so this is how it comes back in to like making negotiation possible. I mean, that would be one of the drivers behind, you know, trying to do that, getting these special requests met for accommodations and modifications.
So exactly. And this push for these accommodations, actually, from what I've seen firsthand, and again, this is anecdotal, but I've seen, of course, many other educators and other groups that have spoken to this in other states. So, you know, when you get enough anecdotes, it starts to become, you know, a thing that seems to be a trend, you know.
Yeah.
But basically, the push to get young people diagnosed is stemming from the state mandated tests and the district tests. And the reason why that's happening is because, especially at the higher performing schools or administrations that are looking to get more funding or get better rankings, they need to have as many students as possible pass these district or state tests for their funding and for their rankings. Well, what's the quickest way to do that? Get them as many accommodations as possible. Get them 100% extended time. Get them, you know, oral instructions. Get them an ESC coordinator or a specialist who can help them, right? Mm-hmm. And I watched this when I was teaching at the middle school I was teaching, that there was a huge push to get as many young people on an accommodation plan as quickly as possible because they wanted their pass rates. And anybody who was going to be a problem or a threat to that, they wanted to try to edge out of the school because they were so interested in keeping up their appearances. They wanted to bully who they could who wouldn't meet that standard out. And if there was someone who wasn't meeting the standard, get them onto some type of special plan so that they could have as much of a chance as possible to pass the state and district exams.
Mm-hmm.
And the tragic consequence of this, of course, is that lots of young people are just being treated as if there's something wrong with them or dysfunctional. They're being told, oh, you know, you have a problem. You know, there's something that's fundamentally wrong with you. We need to get you these special accommodations, things like that. And of course, you know, even without that, it's just there's no respect of individual development or autonomy. There's no respect of understanding individual biology or outside life circumstances that might be affecting them. It's just, okay, do whatever you have to do to make sure they pass these tests.
And if you're not disabled, we'll disable you with a label. To be continued.
Wasting my time in the waiting line.